Actually, you know, my guess is I'm going to take less than the hour today, and so I don't have.
You may take less than
Yeah, I know my past experiences. But, so I wanted to cover two different kinds of topics, and it won't be really in depth. It'll really just be kind of a descriptive thing, and hopefully can stimulate further discussion, and I can provide some references, and maybe it will provide us with the basis for conversation in the next week or two or something. So anyway, the two topics, I want to talk a little bit about migration, models with structure, and Bob talked some about models like that, and he analyzed some data with respect to that, but I wanted to kind of back up and talk about some very simple models with of migration, and then I'll talk a little bit about recombination. And for both these topics, as I say, it'll be a fairly superficial treatment, but I think it'll help to get us sort of started. So migration, the model I'm going to talk about the most is what is referred to as an island model, which is what Bob talked about a little bit yesterday. So, the case I'll consider first is just where there's just two populations, so population one and population two. And I'm going to consider a very symmetric case to begin with. It's obviously pretty easily generalizable to much less symmetric sort of thing. And the way the picture I sort of draw for it is that there's a migration parameter, which I think was a backward migration rate, which is sort of the, I think of it as this small m being the fraction of this population each generation, which is made up of migrants from the other population. So each, in this symmetric version of the model, each of these subpopulations, a fraction, each generation is sort of thought of as having been moved over from the other side. And I'm going to imagine that I've got n diploids on each of these, so everything's completely symmetric. So the total population size is of diploids is 2n, which means there are 4n copies of every gene. In each subpopulation, there are 2n copies of the gene. So I have the same diploidy mess that I had before. And Bob talked about, in general, getting likelihoods by, you know, setting up some sort of, by finding the recursion and developing an important sampling sort of scheme. And I'm going to talk about a couple other simple properties of mostly samples of size 2, either both from one of these or one from each of them. And this is sort of characteristic of a lot of population genetics over the last 30 or 40 years, that in analyzing any model where people got discouraged right away that they get sort of complete results, they'd start talking about samples of size 2 and they'd ask, what's the expected number of differences between two, between in a sample size 2, and they'd look at the expectation of the total number of polymorphic sites in this. So these two summary quantities were usually the first kind of thing one calculated, and was in a lot of cases sort of viewed as a breakthrough if you got those for a model that was. So it's much more ambitious what Bob does to try to get these full likelihoods. And then people would try based on these or maybe a few other kinds of ways of summarizing the data to make inferences about the parameters based on these observed, you know, average number of differences between pairs or the total number of polymorphic sites. And so, and usually those were sort of moment estimators that one would use. Sort of match up your observed number with the expected formula for the expected number and try and solve for parameters, get estimates that way. So that's, if you read the literature of population genetic inference on data, this is sort of the level at which most of it's done. And it sort of helped. I mean, So in this case, we might, in the spirit of this, ask if I sample two copies from this population, how many differences do I expect between those? And that's obviously closely related under an infinite site model to what's the expected time to the common ancestor of these two. And then if I sample one from here and one from here, same kind of thing. What's the expected number of differences and maybe the variance, and what's the, and that's related, of course, if you can get the expected time of the common ancestor of these two. And it's quite easy if you think about the process of sort of going back in time to the ancestry of these things to write down a simple set of equations to get this one in particular, the expected number of differences, as a function of this migration parameter and the population sizes. So, and one way, the way I usually think about that problem is I ask, if I'm sampling two from here and this small m is small and big n is pretty big, then basically I go back and tell the first event is one of these lineages moving over into this population, as you go back to its ancestor being the other population, or that you get a common ancestor. And the probability per generation of getting common ancestor is this, and the probability per generation that one of the other lineages moves to the other side is approximately that, in this case where small m is small. So it's very much like this mutation. Before I looked at a case where we're looking at mutation here and coalescent. But you have these different states of the ancestor. Both the ancestors can be here, or one of the ancestors can be here and one here, or both of them can be over here. But since this is all symmetric, it doesn't matter whether they're both here or both here. So anyway, from thinking of that kind of Markov process going back, it's quite easy to derive properties of the times of the common ancestor of this thing. And it turns out that the expected time to the common ancestor of two drawn from the same population, like calling, turns out to just be 4n. And the expected time to the common ancestor when you take two of them from a different population turns out to be 4n plus 1 over 2m. And once you buy this one, this result's pretty straightforward, because if you sample two from here, under the assumptions of the model, you can't get common ancestors between them until their ancestors get in the same population. So you just have a waiting time until they get to the same population, and then the additional time has to be this time here. But this is a little bit surprising at first, and I want to say a word or two about this result. And it turns out that if you construct an island model with many subpopulations, but all communicating all of them with every other one at the same rate, that the expected time when you draw two from the same population is just twice the total number of individuals in the whole population all added up. So the fact this doesn't depend on the migration rate is what's weird, and that generalizes to a much larger class of models with many subpopulations. There's certain constraints on the migration rates, but they don't even all have to be symmetric and everything. There's a pretty large class of models where this kind of thing works. So
wouldn't you think the migration rate is like negligible? Then it should only depend on...
Right. It should be like this is isolated. And this contradicts that.
If the migration rate is 1, then it should... Whole.
That's right. So if the migration rate is 0, this is not correct, because then this time has to be just 2n. So this is for m greater than 0. But anywhere close to 0, that's right. So that's what's the interesting observation that I want to make a comment. Yeah.
This must be an issue of exchanging limits, right? So this must be somehow taking n to infinity at
yes, that's correct.
Not zero or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. These are coalescent limits. But the way I think about how this works is that as the migration rate gets smaller and smaller and smaller, you're almost certainly going to have just a coalescent within here. And that distribution of those times will look like the distribution as if this didn't exist over here. But with some very small probability, you get something that goes over there. And if it goes over there, it has to wait a very long time that's proportional to 1 over n to get back again.
But then sort of this 4n result becomes more and more irrelevant.
That's absolutely correct. That's right. That's absolutely right. And the higher moments are strongly affected by the migration rate. The variance of this is going off to infinity. So that's absolutely right. But people use this result and say, well, I can estimate the sort of a global population size by just looking at differences in here. But people also, at other times, sort of forget about this kind of result and think, well, I don't know about all the rest of the population and all these other things, so I'm going to analyze this as if it's a two-population model. And this suggests that you shouldn't do that. And, yeah.
Do these same arguments and results hold, instead of thinking of two populations, if you think of duplicated genes that are exchanging alleles at some rate by some gene conversion?
I think something like that applies. I'm not sure if it... So everybody understand Marty's question? There are parts of the genome where a gene is duplicated, and if you sort of ignore this one over here, you think, well, the normal coalescent processing, but occasionally a copy here actually has an ancestor which is from this other copy in the genome. So there's this kind of low probability event that you get. And I think it's very analogous to this sort of migration model. And I think something like this happens. Yeah. I can't remember if it comes out quite
so. It's just on the context that maybe some people might.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, people will use these results about what divergence they expect between sequences sampled here and what divergence they expect here, take observations of that those patterns and data, and then try to match them up with this model. And so the in units, when you get divergences, you know, this usually things are get scaled in a way so you can make an inference about 4nm, and usually you'll simultaneously make an estimate of an inference about this mutation parameter and the population size. And so you'll make inferences about this based on just these summary quantities from the data. I didn't have a whole lot more to say about this particular one, except one other kind of interesting feature. If you consider a very large number of these kind of populations, so suppose you start to consider greater and greater numbers of these populations, and then imagine you sample in a way that maybe only you get one or zero individuals sampled from populations. It turns out that this thing starts to look like, so if I have a large number of these and I sample just one sequence here, one sequence here, one sequence here. There's some fairly broad set of conditions where the ancestry of these now actually looks like the single panmictic population coalescent in terms of, but with a different time scale. So for example, if I just sample two, you can imagine that with these large number of populations that the time back might be roughly exponentially distributed. If you every generation you have some small probability of getting into the same population and coalescing soon after that. So you can imagine that looks kind of like a geometric or an exponential distribution for two. And if you have sampled several from different ones, that you might have this characteristic that the rate would be proportional to n choose two for finding some two to come together. So it turns out that the sort of ancestral tree in this situation, we have many, many subpopulations, and you're sampling only one or zero from several of them, that the ancestry looks a lot like this standard panmictic population genealogy, but the time scale is different and depends on details of the migration rates and structure and the rates of the migration rate. And John Wakely was the one who sort of, I think, pursued that in most detail, maybe even recognized it first and pursued it. So he's done some interesting work on that sort of modeling, kind of what the conditions are, et cetera. So part of my reason for wanting to introduce this migration, just talk about it in a little more detail here, even though it had come up before, is it has analogies in a lot of these other circumstances. Marty was already bringing up the duplicated gene. But there's situations where you might consider a particular nucleotide site in the genome where selection is operating such a way that the allele frequency sort of stays constant over a long period of time. Selection, some kind of balancing selection, keeps both alleles in the population. And maybe if that selection is strong, that frequency is a function of time, hovers around some value. And then if you take samples, the present time copies of the gene, and look at linked variation around that gene, the way that works, so if these are, big A allele, there's a little A allele, that these things will only have common ancestors, or things that carry the same allele here can have common ancestors, the same allele here, but the probability getting a mutation, a common ancestor in the same generation from these is negligible. And so the behavior of this, it's the modeling is in a lot of ways analogous to this kind of migration structure. So if you're considering a region that's very tightly linked to this site, this selected site, then there's very little exchange between these two because the recombination rate is low. And on the other hand, if you consider sites that are far away from the selected site, recombination sort of takes you back and forth across this very often, and then this becomes sort of irrelevant in some sense. So anyway, there's a lot of analogies to those migration models, and so I wanted to say just a few more words about it. So that's all I was going to say about migration. Now I'll talk a little bit about
one additional question regarding that ancestor tree of different subpopulations.
Yeah.
When n times m is much smaller than 1, then the time scale is simply given by 1 over m, also that's quiescent.
Yeah, you're talking about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you have lots of subpopulations, you have to wait, 1 over m generation.
M takes the role of n.
But then there's once you get in the same population, there's a certain probability that you'll coalesce in there or that you'll migrate, they'll jump out again. So you may have to come back, get them into the same population several times. And how? That's right. If it's small enough that you automatically do it. So that's a function of n times m, presumably, right? So if this is very small, that's what you're saying, actually. Okay. Very small. Okay, other comments, questions? Okay. So let me now talk about recombination a little bit, and I'll present maybe no results with recombination, but I just want to describe the process, recombination, and so the way I like to start in talking about this is really to consider just a single chunk of DNA that you sample from a population now and ask about its history. Now, in the case where there's no recombination, I talked about this case because the history is pretty boring. It has an ancestor and has an ancestor, etc. But with recombination, what happens is that each generation, in the usual sort of models, each generation there's a probability that that this thing has two parents of the previous generation. And I like to sort of draw it like this, where I have a dotted line. And so these two parents, the left half of this one and the right half of this one, combined to produce this offspring. And as I say, in the backwards direction, with this, in the forward direction, too, the probability that this thing has two different parents is parameterized by this quantity R, the recombination rate. And I'll talk a little bit about two locus models where we really just sort of have a locus, a recombination, and some distance and another locus, and the recombination rates between these, and there's no you can think of this as a block of DNA within which no recombination occurs, or you can think of this as a single nucleotide site, something like that. Or you can think of this as sort of a continuous segment, many, many base pairs long. And in the case where it's many, many base pairs long, you think of this place at which this exchange occurred, this break point here, as having some distribution along the sequence. And to start off with, when usually it just assumes that's uniform. Now, if it's not, in terms of just properties of genealogies and ancestry, you can just think of sort of transforming distances, and just think of this in recombinational units, and then you're fine. But if mutation has sort of a different pattern of variation across the sequences, then you have to, at some point, you have to get them both on the same scale to kind of, that may not make sense to anybody. But basically, I'm going to assume that these things would happen sort of uniformly along the segment, that this has this crossover point is uniformly distributed. But it's quite important that in some organisms, in particular humans, that on a base pair basis, recombination is very heterogeneous. There are long stretches of cold spots where recombination almost never occurs, and dramatic hot spots. And that's where a lot of the action has been in the last few years, is trying to nail that down better in humans by combination of experimental work and inference under population genetic models. So in any case, in the case of a continuous segment here, the history goes like this, and then the next event back could be to bring them back together, but the next event could be another recombination event where this thing breaks up into, and now one ancestor looks like that, and the other one looks like. So that's what this one has done, and this one maybe is tracing back and is still the same. This diagram's going to get ugly, but what I'm indicating is by the dotted portions are pieces of DNA in these ancestral segments which don't have descendant material in this sampled individual down here. So as you go back in time, you get this breaking up and breaking and breaking up, but then the coalescent process is happening with this rate proportion, you know, quadratic in the number of different chromosomes you've gotten broken up to, and so you reach some kind of stochastic equilibrium between this sort of breaking up and coming together. Now, if you think about the ancestry of this piece, if this ancestor one generation earlier, if this individual is a recombinant descendant from the previous generation, but the crossover was over in here, it doesn't really have any effect on properties of the gene tree that we typically can observe down here. So if you're thinking about, you know, implementing this on a computer, you might try and not keep track of, you might throw out these and not record those as part of the history, but that's a minor sort of detail. But when I first started thinking about this process, I was sort of curious if I could learn something about even the expected number of these ancestors that actually have descendant material in this chromosome as a function of this parameter R, and presumably it really just depends on 4 and R. I could say something about the distribution of ancestral material and how it was broken up and on how many chromosomes and all this stuff. And it seems like quite a simple process in a way, but I think it's very hard to get anything out of this, and it's partly because all this spatial structure in here is sort of critical to kind of understanding the dynamics of what happens next depends so much on, you know, on how far out to the edges there's ancestral material but anyway, when I first started thinking about it, I thought maybe this breaks up into such tiny little pieces of ancestral material, sort of on off, on off, on off, or something in this model, and it stays pretty clunky, you know, it turns out. I mean, if you do 4NR equals, you know, 20 or something like that, the number of ancestors doesn't get too big, and the number of, on any one ancestral chromosome, the number of disjunct pieces that are ancestral, this turns out not to be that big. That's what I've observed from simulations, but I can't get any analytical results or about that process. So it's intriguing, but I think it's seductive, but difficult.
From the number of people we've had to go out this.
Is that right? Okay. Okay.
Is there some new data set that's motivating people to do this calculation? I mean, in the infinite space of possible things you could calculate.
Yeah. No, I don't know. To me, it's just appealing. I don't know that the data. I mean, one of the reasons this is still just aesthetics, I suppose. But people talked about sort of the mitochondria. There's this mitochondrial Eve. You know, there's the common ancestor of all our mitochondria on the planet, and that existed maybe 200,000 years ago or something like that. And you could think about making inferences, say, about how long ago that existed, et cetera. If you think about regions with recombination, at any one nucleotide site, there's such an ancestor. But for any block, there's this randomly distributed number as you go back in time. So if I took a bigger sample of many individuals and asked something about the ancestor, and people have sort of been, I don't know, I've been sort of curious on how many individuals in the far past are the descendants, are the ancestors of current, say, hemoglobin genes, how many individuals is that distributed on? And if you think of a structured model, are those ancestors from all over the world or what? As sort of a null model anyway, and with selection, presumably that'd be different. So I should just say I don't know the practical application of the problem.
Yeah, but the fundamental observation about any data set on variation is that variation is clustered. It's clustered on haplotypes.
Oh, yeah, this model is relevant for interpreting data. It's just this question about how many ancestors there were is the only thing I was... Yeah.
That question, but just more generally, it's very important.
But for example, is there some... So if I understand correctly, there are interesting simulations where one can measure this or that. So is there some particular result that you can infer from the simulation, say the scaling and the number of ancestors as a function of n?
But do you mean this big N or the number
small? So as a function of your NR parameter.
Yeah.
It's sort of a suitable challenge for...
There's a lot of programs around that will simulate this process, and you can simulate that rapidly and to your heart's content and sort of look for patterns and, yeah.
But so are there, you know, just...
Well...
Did somebody look at some particular object that you consider interesting, say the number of ancestors, and gave a curve with some recognizable scalar function of
NR? I think there's been published papers on that. Jotun Hein, maybe?
And
Carsten Wolf.
Wolf and Hein.
Yeah.
Wolf and Hein, W-I-U-F. There's other sort of recombination papers you should read, like Dick's papers, my papers as well, on this, if you want the theory. For applied papers, I guess there's, I don't know the area very well, I don't know if Chris knows people considering ancestry, you know, recombination ancestry. Mm-hmm. In a practical way, I guess there are people doing that, but I'm not so sure of the literature in that.
Yeah, I mean, people all the time with data will look at it and
even
say they will say, "Oh, this looks like a block within which there's been no recombination, and it looks like there's been a recombination event," and they'll do sort of ad hoc descriptions of the data and that way, and actually utilize that for. They'd like to apply some analysis that doesn't have recombination, and so they'll stare at their data and try and figure out blocks that look like they don't have much recombination and apply these no recombination methods. And so I'm going to talk about a few other kinds of results about this, but so my comment about not having any practical utility was just about this number of ancestor problem that I just found aesthetically appealing and drew me in 30 years ago, and I realized I couldn't get anywhere on it. Except to do simulations. I mean, so simulations of this for samples, as I say, is quite straightforward to do, and you can do it in the context of models with population size changing and structure and geographic structure and all kinds of complications. So you can generate these histories and put mutations down it. And that has been a useful thing to do in order to kind of get a feel for how certain summary statistics work, et cetera.
But conversely, there's many, including ones you've developed, ways to try to estimate that recombination rate.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's I'm going to say a few words about that. Oh. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Another question.
Yeah.
You said that the contribution, you get most a finite number. If you go back in time, a finite number.
Yeah, there's this breaking up process, which to begin with happens rate R, but then, and with one event, it looks like it's still R because you really only care about recombination events that happen in there and there, so that still adds to the same amount as before. But once you get another one, and then you get, say, a common ancestor between this one and this one, then the ancestors got, you've got an ancestral piece here and a gap and then an ancestral piece in there, and then you care about recombinations in here as well as ones out there. So, sorry, I interrupted you. You're gonna
the contribution of those ancestors to the present state is more or less homogeneous, or do you have
there's always one ancestor of any particular spot along here.
If you have a given ancestor and you look how much stretch of DNA does it contribute to the present state, you can look at the distribution of this. Maybe there are some that have a very strong contribution.
Yeah, you mean a big block of... But I don't think the properties of that, except by simulation, that we have any...
But there is one, you see, the point is that there is one common ancestor of all these bits that break up eventually.
Oh, eventually, these will randomly eventually come back. Yeah.
So it's quadratic in its joining together in the coalescence rate. But it's linear in the breakup rate, in the recombination. So that's enough to make sure that it was probably one you do actually have an ancestor again. Right. So it does this. It starts off and goes up, as Dick says, then it hits a common.
It eventually gets back to one of these, but then it breaks up again.
So it does it again.
Yeah.
And then the quadratic of interest thing doesn't kick in anymore.
Say that again. I missed that.
So she was arguing that this little n over 2, and little n choose 2 is quadratic, and the other part is linear.
Right.
But this little n is bounded.
Oh, by
n.
Yeah. Well, actually, mostly representing results are sort of a lemon case where this is going off to infinity and that's going to 0. And
Then you have all the room for your little n.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so this thing breaks apart, eventually comes back together, breaks apart, comes back together, and there's some sort of stationary distribution for that ancestral.
Yeah, there's a stationary distribution for the object, sample path between bits. Yeah.
Well, anyway, so this is really just sort of a warm-up exercise for us, because it's not really relevant to a practical problem in a sense. But so normally what we're interested in is, you know, we have a set of sequences and their ancestry. But it's, you know, in terms of description of the process, they're just all doing this thing of breaking apart, and they can coalesce between one of these ancestors look like this, and one of the ancestors, one of these others coalesce. One of the crucial things to say is in this model now with recombination, if you look at any one site, if we've constructed this thing in a way we'd want to, presumably the ancestry, the genealogical tree for that one site ought to have the distribution of the standard no recombination Kingman coalescent sort of tree. And if your model here didn't result in that, you'd basically just say you haven't built your model right here, because you definitely want the marginal genealogical properties for a site here to be just the standard no recombination one. And the process, as I've described it here, although somewhat incomplete maybe and fuzzy, is one that leads to that property. So what in some sense what the recombination does is make it so that very tightly linked sites have maybe the same genealogical history in any realization, or as you start to get farther away and there starts to be real probability of recombination, trees that can start to differ a little bit from one site. So as you get over here, the gene tree for this site is different from the gene tree from this site, typically. But it will have elements in common. There may be coalescent events that happen before any recombination event happens, and then all the sites across this region will have shared that coalescent event, and that part of their history will be the same. But then you get recombination events which take pieces off and allow them to have different histories, genealogies go farther back or coalesce sooner, et cetera. So in some sense, what this recombination does is generate a set of genealogical histories that are strongly correlated for neighboring sites and weakly correlated for far away distant sites. And that non-independence between those things generated by this process is what's difficult to analyze and hard to do things like get the likelihood of this data set that you would get of this type. But it's possible to do it, and Bob was maybe the first to write down the recursions the kind of recursions he talked about yesterday in the context of this kind of recombination model. And you can write down those recursions. You can develop an important, they presented an important sampling scheme for estimating this likelihood, but it takes many, it's very computationally intensive for regions that are of any size. So if 4NR per base pair in humans might be on the order of 0.002 or something like that. So 1,000 base pairs, maybe it's around 2. And 10,000 base pairs, 20. And already at 4NR equals 20, so for 10,000 base pairs, the kind of important sampling technique that Bob presented just is impossible to get to behave well and work. Now,
I think if you had a good sort of important sampling distribution back in time, we could prove it.
Yeah, and in fact, Fernhead and Donnelly made some improvements, right?
Donnelly as well, but I think it'd be fair to say they had a lot of problems as well. It
wasn't
easy. And I think it's sort of gone out of fashion because it's so hard.
Right.
So many runs.
But there might be.
But as I said, yeah. I still sort of have this hope that if you really had a proper sort of idea of what the backwards transitions were, you'd do way better.
I see. So, yeah, I think that's a fair characterization, too. So these important sampling schemes can be shown to work for fairly small regions, for sure. But for the bigger kind of problems that people want to solve now, they have not done it. And there have been two or three other alternatives that have been presented. And usually the context of getting this likelihood is really an effort to estimate that parameter. That's the typical problem that people are after.
There's a sort of issue here in the sense that how much can you really tell from a current data set when it's got a very complicated past history? And you can only expect to tell so much because it's like sort of trying to guess some really complicated thing back in history when you've only got today's data. So if you keep increasing the complexity of the models back in time, it's harder and harder to actually tell what happened from your current day data. And I think that makes sense in this context.
Yeah. So anyway, there has been this great interest in trying to estimate this parameter because a lot of properties of these population genetic models and a lot of people's methodologies and all that stuff depend on this parameter. So let me just briefly describe a couple of the other methods that people have used. And one of them that I can't say too much about because I really don't understand it that well is this thing that Lee and Stevens have sort of developed, I guess. Actually, its antecedents maybe. I should give credit to some other.
Yeah, not
Donnelly or I was. I don't know. Bob, probably. Yeah.
But the recognition rate is very high.
Yeah.
Can't you use other methods like sperm or for example, just trace the pedigree, because there are many recombinations going on.
People do have estimates of recombination rates in humans from pedigrees. But.
And they are good when the recombination rate is high.
That's right, or the markers are far apart. So that's the way people usually think about it. So they'll have pedigrees and they'll have some markers scattered across the chromosome, and they're much more dense than that, but they're still the distance. It doesn't help you that much to have markers every 1,000 base pairs for that experiment because you get so few crossovers. So what people usually say is it's sort of megabase scale estimates that they get from pedigrees. So those definitely exist, and they're an important part of assessing whether these population genetic schemes are working, but the data doesn't tell you much of anything about fine scale, that kind of data. Now, it turns out there's another kind of data where people have developed ways of looking at very small regions with sperm typing where they can examine very, very large numbers of sperm and look for and detect recombination events in a very small region. So it's an expensive, labor-intensive process, but they can all, in those experiments, then they can look down at the scale of 10,000 base pairs or 20,000 base pairs and actually detect that crossovers are happening in this little region and not over in this little region, with a moderate number of events that they can detect in those kind of experiments. So there are two different scales in which one can do experiments, and both of those have been crucial in kind of trying to evaluate whether these things, these population genetic methods, not this one because it just doesn't.
Roughly speaking, computational methods, you can get up to 20 kb.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So
that overlaps that with
one, the,
yeah.
That one is for the megabases.
Yeah, this one is megabase scale, yeah.
And the sperm typing is...
is more like, I think, 10 kb, 20 kb, something like that, yeah.
And I guess it's worth pointing out that, it's kind of irrelevant maybe for the thinking about the coalescent process, but the recombination rate is not necessarily the same in the two sexes. It's different in humans, and flies are a lot smarter than humans. They don't have any recombination in males. There's no recombination. All recombination is in females.
Yeah, so that's a good point. This population genetic thing is going to be kind of this average rate over sexes, males and females, and then you have the sperm typing in males. But it's actually then been interesting to show that you get this strong correspondence actually suggesting that females is not completely different or something. You know, you don't get an inference of a hotspot that's due to female crossing over, not male.
Maybe another piece of biology to throw in is that the recombination positions change quite rapidly in evolution. So the hotspots that are found in the human genome are essentially not found in the chimpanzee genome in the same places.
Yeah. And in fact, I think it's been demonstrated now, they can demonstrate different humans have demonstrably different patterns of hotspots and cold spots. So
and recombination rates, I mean, dramatic.
Yeah.
I think Molly, you know, we're expecting her to be here, and Graham. We'll hear
they can talk. Yeah, they know one more than us.
So what kind of seminar long enough? And then what kind of average recombination rate between the two of us?
Yeah. So all of the recent methods, and I haven't even got to them, have to face the fact there's heterogeneity and have to be actually trying to make inferences specifically about that heterogeneity. So I'll say a word or two about that in a minute. But
people have done simulations, for example, with the heterogeneous population, right? To apply this and see what
average. So the heterogeneous population, I don't think anybody's done the methodology. This is a long-term average of these genealogical histories that go back 500 to 700,000 years, you know, 20,000 generations or something. So they're not worrying about that. But the heterogeneity spatially across the genome, people definitely have focused on, and it's really considered sort of inappropriate to assume some model is uniform across them. I'm sure there was a couple of things I was going to say in there. But anyway, I was going to describe a couple other of these kind of approximate ad hoc methods that people have used to try and make this inference of recombination rate. And because they've kind of, they're waiting for Bob to solve the problem for the full likelihood. So they're and one is Lee and Stevens, and they have this method that's based on a thing called a product of approximate conditionals. And I can't say too much about it because I don't have any great understanding of it. But they basically, it's a scheme where you think of trying to calculate the probability of a sample like this by starting with some arbitrary one of them and then looking at the next one and trying to interpret it in terms of possibly something that's a duplicate, possibly with mutational errors, and a region that might be recombinant that came sort of somewhere else. And you keep adding in chromosomes, and you know this one is this type, and then maybe this one looks kind of like that one for there, and then this end of it kind of looks like that. Anyway, there's a way of getting some kind of approximate probability of this conditional on that, and then this conditional on both of those, and this conditional on those, and it's really sort of a plausible something that might be approximately the right thing. And you end up then with a product of all of those. So each one takes into account something about all the previous ones, but it's not an exact calculation. This seems like a plausible probability for this conditional on those, and it's motivated by some, you know, real theory, but it's approximate. And the result, the likelihood you get actually depends on the order in which you add the chromosomes, so that's an indication that it's not doing the right thing. And they typically then will do that for a bunch of random different orders of the samplings from that and get an average. And it seems to work remarkably well, and pretty much almost as well as any other alternatives, and I'll describe a couple of other alternatives. And it's fairly fast, and they combine it with a bunch of other things of estimating phase and what they and the that product, this product that they're doing here is a function of the recombination rate, and if you have spatial heterogeneity, it's a function of the recombination rate across, you know, the recombination map function.
What is the definition of well?
Yeah, so there's sort of two tests that people apply, and I'm still going to be vague, but I'll try to get slightly more specific. One is you generate data in a computer under this model with heterogeneity rates or whatever complication you want, and then you pass it through their scheme and you plot the distribution of their outcomes and do the usual sort of thing. So that's the first scheme. And backing up just a little bit, the important sampling schemes get likelihoods. One of the problems is they're so computationally intensive, it's very hard to even do that step because you don't want to do more than once. So there is some. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it's often difficult. Whereas when you get to these computationally fast, relatively simple, then you could do lots of that kind of testing. You could look at robustness, the departures from the simple model, and see if it's still working. And the other thing, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, in all these methods, is it assumed that there is only one crossover event in each generation?
Most of them, I think that's typical, yeah. I think that's right.
These models are sort of hidden markup models or something. They have some sort of spirit of the coalescent process, but they're not exactly, in effect, correct. They're sort of a dreamed up kind of scenario that has some aspects that are correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so actually, so when I say the probably this conditional on that, it's not thinking of that as being like this is a parent and this is a descendant, it's one generation. So there actually can be several recombination events because you're thinking of that ancestry as going back all the way through the ancestry of all these.
But, in the process,
but this over here, yeah, it was one. Yeah, yeah, it was. That's typically thinking of this R as being a small number. And, yeah, that's right. Actually, I don't know whether this makes it worse or better, but it turns out biologically, well, I know. What I was going to say is biologically, it turns out that there's actually inhibitions on getting another crossover close by. Things actually tend to be sort of spaced out a little bit.
For HIV, which I work with, I think it's more common to have more than one crossover in each generation.
Yeah.
That's what motivated my question.
Yeah. In whole chromosomes, there'd be more than one. Maybe not all that often, but not rarely, there'd be more than one. And one does analyze full chromosomes, but usually you're analyzing it in sort of blocks that are much smaller, and you're not really doing some sort of simultaneous analysis. So I don't think that is a problem there. The other biological process I want to talk about that may be quite important is when you go back one generation, a thing that we think happens fairly often, but we don't know how often, is that the ancestor looks like this. This is a very small block. So instead of getting this standard crossover where everything to one side is from one parent, everything in the other, you get this little piece that came from here and went in there. And that's a gene conversion.
That's what we call two crossovers.
That's right. But this special case of this happening on this very small time scale, where this we think that this is are usually things on the order of less than 500 base pairs or something like that. And so you won't get them. So it's usually these are usually thought of as related mechanically happening by processes where the underlying machinery might be sort of the same and they might be connected, but they're usually modeled as, well, I might get one of these kind of events or I might get one of these kind of events. And trying to for not just this recombination parameter, but the rate at which you get these kind of events and what the length of the tracks are that are involved in them. This has been more challenging even than the straight recombination, and yet it's believed that when you're looking at short-range patterns, you look that this might be very important. But when you're looking at markers that are, you know, 20 kb apart or, well, 100 kb apart or something, this process, because they involve these short tracks, things on opposite side of it aren't really affected by it, and that maybe they don't have a big effect. But when you look at sort of short-range pattern of decay of associations, this might be quite important, but it's been quite difficult to estimate this quantity.
Is gene conversion happening at the same time in the cell cycle? I mean, during the...
It's meiotic events.
What are the cells doing when that...
I think so, yeah.
When that happens.
Yeah.
So what are they doing?
They're lining up and mixing it up, right? I mean, there's... These chromosomes get paired up, and then, you know, I don't know enough about the biology, right? I mean, magical things happen, and crossovers happen, and sometimes those are just little short tracks that do that, and sometimes.
Well, there has been a very recent study in yeast, created this summer, where they, in 100 meiosis, had a marker density of a couple of hundred base pairs, and really nailed down every crossover and every conversion event. And you see these stretches of like 1,000 bases that are converted from one chromosome to the other. And they seem to occur, at least in yeast, it's pretty much equal likelihood. And 1% of the genome is converted in each generation.
But in, you know, the classic model, sort of the final physical configuration of these recombining chromosomes is this holiday structure. And depending on whether or not they break apart on one axis or the other, you have either a gene conversion or a crossover. And since there's no way, it's thought for the enzymes to know what that axis is, you get a one-to-one ratio of gene conversion events as a, to resolve this crossover knot, basically, the holiday junction. But it turns out that gene conversion events can be much, much more common than one-to-one, and there are many things that initiate as recombination events and never make it to a holiday structure, but there might be a crossover, but produce gene conversion events, so it can be a much higher rate of gene conversion, but affecting very small
intervals.
Isn't this related to the reason why we have recombination in the first place? Like, what might the origin of recombination of gene and whether this was advantageous or all that kind of thing. I mean, because gene conversion can do some kind of correction for mutations or something like that. I mean,
yeah, I don't know.
There's a big literature on, you know, on the meaning of recombination, its origin, its relation to sex.
Yeah.
You know,
so
But some people think it's really almost just a some sort of mechanical byproduct of the way segregation occurs, right? And
it's actually required for proper disjunction.
So it's almost like it's a side product.
Some comments about sex and recombination. Why do people think sex is the same as recombination? What's this connection?
Well,
okay.
Yeah. You know,
I've never really understood this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sex puts two genomes together and gives them the opportunity to potentially exchange.
But it can happen. But you get crossing over and these kind of things in haploid organisms, right?
Yeah.
So it's
no. People just view that as one.
The folklore is
sex.
Sex and recombination.
Yeah. There's many different views of
human
imagination.
Okay, so let me just say, so anyway, there exists this method that I can't describe for you, product of approximate conditionals, that does pretty well in simulated data and can actually, on these situations where you have pedigree data from humans, actually detect the hot, do pretty well in in those. Now, another scheme is a form of composite likelihood, and this has been used quite a bit. And Gil McVean is one who's implemented this scheme in really quite a, I think, a quite beautiful way that is that's been used to analyze genome-wide, say, in humans, so they can do some very, 500, the whole genome, 500,000 polymorphic sites or something like that, using this approach. And basically what it is, it turns out we can calculate the likelihood of configurations if we just consider two nucleotide sites. So if we have a sample and you just focus on two nucleotide sites, we can do that problem. Not even that one's, McVean does it, I think, with an important sampling scheme. So even that, you're not going to write down an equation. So he does an important sampling, and you can get the likelihood of a two-site configuration as a function of the recombination rate between them. And he does a model where actually you can have recurrent mutations. He does a two-allele model. So he was motivated to do that because he wanted to analyze some data where the mutation rates were much higher. So he wanted, and if you assume an infinite site model of the type that I've talked about, and then there's been multiple hits back and forth between the same allele, it can mimic the effects of recombination because you get combinations of alleles that you couldn't get without recombination in the infinite site model, but you can get them just by mutation. So anyway, he's got a model that encompasses that, so that's a nice addition to the model. So you can calculate these likelihoods for a pair of sites, and the composite likelihood says, I'm just going to consider all pairwise combinations and take the product of the likelihoods of all the individual pairs, including so that one with that site, that site with that site, that site with that site, just all pairs. And you just take the product as if they were independent. So it seems like a horrifying thing to do. You shiver to think. And damned if it doesn't work very well in the sense of you apply the simulated data and estimate these things. When you look at real data and estimate these things and compare it to the pedigree estimates, it's just incredible. And he has a fairly elaborate scheme to go through and basically estimates a recombination parameter between every pair of sites. And he has a Bayesian sort of scheme that tends to smooth things. So there's a little, in a sense, a kind of a penalty for every time you want to change the rate along here. So there's a Bayesian prior that kind of makes these rates wanting to be the same. And so there's a parameter you tune for that. So he does this reversible jump MCMC and searches the space for, and he has a prior on these 4NR parameters per base pair. And it just is quite amazing. So they apply it to the whole genome. They pick up all the known hot spots, I think. Plus, they have a catalog of 25,000 hotspots in the human genome, and they estimate that recombinant and the way it's the pattern seems to be that there's pretty long stretches of low recombination rate, and then these hotspots that are 1 or 2 kb long, and the rates are maybe 10 to 100 times higher in those hotspots over a region of a kb or so, and they estimate that something like roughly 50% of all crossovers happen in less than 10% of the genome where these hotspots reside. So, so it's an important heterogeneity. And as I say, they do the whole human genome with these data sets, and they infer all these hotspots, and then they've used that to try and make some inference about what might be. For example, they look for motifs in these hotspots to see if they find something, and they've identified some motifs by that kind of method that seem to be account for some substantial fraction of the hotspots that are observed. But as Chris pointed out, if you go to chimpanzees and you look for hotspots there are hotspots, but they're in different places, and yet the sequences are 99% the same. So it seems as though its sequence plays a role in this, but to get the hotspots to move, doesn't you don't have to change the sequence of them. So some of the other machinery somehow that's recognizing it seems as though it's changed or something. But there's a lot of interest in the evolution of these hotspots, and I think it's kind of up in the air right now. So let me just one more minute, and then we can have our break. So that's this composite likelihood method. Another method is to summarize the data in some way that reduces it to a large extent, and then do likelihood on these summary statistics. And one of the ways, I mean, just to give you an example, there are statistics that summarize the level of correlation between variance here and here, linkage disequilibrium statistics. And you can kind of categorize pairs of sites by their degree of correlation by these kind of statistics. And you can just summarize the polymorphism in a big block by how many pairs in this range of distances have linkage disequilibria in this range versus that range versus that range. And just basically make a little table of pairs of sites that fit certain criteria. And then that's your observation now. So it's summarized, condensed. You've thrown away a lot of information. And then you do simulations of some kind just to estimate literally sort of a brute force simulation based on this kind of an algorithm, and ask for a given recombination rate across the region. You know, how likely is it that I get something within epsilon of what I observed in those simulations by some measure of distance, and then you just adjust your parameters, and these simulations are sort of fast enough that you can do a lot of them and explore parameter space to a certain extent. And some of those, I'd say all three of these have had comparable results in kind of how well they're able to estimate these things. And people are usually pretty happy if they can get within a factor of two most of the time. So if you might publish a method and say, I get within a factor of two 80% of the time with this method, and people go, pretty good.
So, but did I understand you correctly? Calculating linkage disequilibrium, taking the inverse as taking the right factor of n, gives pretty much the same result as this fancy method.
I'm not sure of what you said. So linkages, summarizing the data essentially on linkage disequilibrium and sort of categorizing sites in rough bins of distance apart.
You would expect that LD is kind of inversely proportional to the recombination.
That's right. These measures are usually go sort of like that for distances that are very big. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, that's one of the things people have done is they just plot this measure of linkage disequilibrium as a function of distance. And they get this huge cloud. And they plot some thing through and they say, well, that curve looks a lot like if I put 4nr per base pair equal to 0.002. It gives me that curve.
But you could also look at close by stocks and say their linkage disequilibrium is this and that. And
yep.
That would give you some idea of the...
I think it works. It's not bad.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
So can you give a reference on that?
For the summary statistic kind of approach. Yeah. The first author... I couldn't even say the name, let alone spell it. But I can tell you two of the co-authors are on
it. As long as...
So Jeff Wall is one author, Paul Marjoram is another author, and I have it written down here somewhere. The first author has...
Yeah, I'm saying, we're going to hear a lot more about this. Jeff Wall is going to be here. Here and next week on Monday, Eric Zing is going to be here, and he has another method, which he also has some kind of approximation to a coalescing process, and he uses that with some rather high power computation. So it'll be fun. And I think he's competed his against all these other computer scientists. So we're going to quiz him.
Now, the chances that I actually have spelled that right up there are probably not so good, so the other names might be.
Three words.
So I should stop.
That's the genetics from 2006, November?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Spell it right.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm done. Yeah. McVean, I'm not sure he's the first author. Let me see. Yeah.
We can get those references and put it up on the site.
So there's been quite a few papers that McVean has put out with some co-authors reanalyzing data, reanalyzing. But the first one where they kind of outline the method, I think, is maybe 2004 or something.
On which
Ron, we should probably do all three.
Wait, Dick, if you would just...
Yeah, sure.
I wanted to put you up because I thought that was especially volunteering just too much.
You need a
postdoc
coming. I don't know what his last name was, but he said just out of sheer defiance.
Yeah, definitely.
And he only has a single legal name.
Well, no,
No,
that wasn't what I'm talking about. It's another summary statistic one, so it's relevant. But I was thinking there was one on this composite likelihood method that I was looking for. That's Gil McVean. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure it's 2004 in a science paper. Yeah.